This is the Hervoye Moritz Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome to the program. We should be joined by Dr. Meryl Nass, who is an internal medicine physician and activist with expertise in anthrax and bioterrorism. It was 2 years ago and 2 years and 2 months that I had been the first to interview Dr. Francis Boyle, the author of the Bioweapons Act, and he's also published a book on bioterrorism. And our interview went viral, 300,000 views on YouTube before it got nuked by YouTube. And we had a hit piece written about us by the Associated Press, which was co-written with someone from the Atlantic Council, the NATO's think tank. And then, interestingly, that same week, I got my Patreon terminated. So that's that overlap between big tech and the military-industrial pharmaceutical complex. Are you with us, Dr. Nass?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you for taking the time. I've seen your name popping up all over the place in independent media, and I've looked at your work, which is fantastic. I think you're one of us fighting for truth. And before we, you know, get your take on what's going on, could you perhaps inform the audience, briefly tell us about your background and the themes and projects that you've worked on?
Sure. So I'm an old lady. I'm 71. I'm a physician, and I've been sort of fighting the system over different issues for over 30 years. I began looking into anthrax and biological warfare, and 30 years ago was able to prove that the world's largest anthrax epidemic, which occurred in Rhodesia at the end of its civil war, was due to biological warfare. And subsequently, I got into the causes of Gulf War syndrome, and then anthrax vaccine became an issue. It was to be given to all troops in the United States. It was a dangerous vaccine. It was a contributor to Gulf War syndrome. And I fought with a large number of wonderful military people to try to get rid of the license and stop that with those forced vaccinations. And subsequently, I've looked at other epidemics. And for the last two plus years, I've been talking about COVID. I've sort of focused almost exclusively on COVID because it's so immense. The story keeps unraveling, and yet it's amazing that people don't get it. But I guess we've lost, we have no major media anymore that are telling the truth. So we rely on media like TNT to let people know what's really going on. Anyway, So I switched my medical practice to trying to care for COVID patients and to get people hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, that are very useful for treating COVID, especially hydroxychloroquine in particular, only in the early phase, only during about the first week or so. Ivermectin, much more useful early on, but is helpful later. And warning people about problems with the vaccines. So my medical license got suspended in January because I was spreading misinformation and I was a dire threat to the public. There were no allegations that I'd harmed a single patient. There were no patient complaints. Two medical professionals who complained did not allege that I had done anything wrong. They only alleged that I had prescribed ivermectin to one person and hydroxychloroquine to another, and they were sure that this was horse paste. And that even the medical board thinks the emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine has been lifted and therefore it can't be prescribed when legally it certainly can. So I'm now in the position of fighting the medical board and the state of Maine over trying to get my license back. And that's my story.
Yeah, that's crazy. As you say, I still can't believe people don't get it after 2+ years of what's been going on. And, you know, talking about anthrax, I remember listening to interviews of Francis Boyle saying same thing. I think he agrees with you. I think he actually also fought against some of those vaccines. And I remember in graduate school, I had been in contact with Doug Rocky, mm-hmm. who works with the DU for one of my papers in yes. grad school. And
Doug actually died of COVID last year.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, wow. Sorry to hear that. And I was also, yeah, and you're going to mention, you brought up what happened to you with your license. Dr. Paul Thomas out in Oregon, who I'm a big fan of, pediatrician, mm-hmm. I've read his book, which has helped me make the correct decisions for my family as well. His license got pulled mm-hmm. Also after, I think it was like the same week where he published using data from his own practice of, I think, 1,000+ right. Children. It clearly, people should go find that. I think it was a peer-reviewed publication, how the unvaccinated children were by far healthier and had less adverse,
less medical problems. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and that same week, his license got pulled mysteriously, again, with no, and it was illegal, basically, and eventually he got, I think, his license back, and I think he's in the process of getting it back. So this is what's going on, this powerful pharmaceutical lobby. And so let's then get into what I like to call COVID-1984, COVID-911, whatever one wants to call it, but what's been happening over the past 2+ years, this so-called pandemic, this talk of, biological warfare. I mean, I still have questions. I don't believe it's a natural event. I'm still between whether it's a gain-of-function virus, or if they're just, maybe there isn't a virus at all. And then we've got these insane lockdowns and this medical tyranny. What's your thought on the past 2+ years of what's been going on, as well as the COVID-19 origin?
Sure. Well, obviously, I shouldn't say obviously. There's a virus. If this is not a virus, then there is no cold virus. There is no measles virus. There is no influenza virus. This is a virus. It spreads from person to person. It spreads rapidly within households. But there are a lot of asymptomatic cases and mild cases. It was clearly developed in a lab. This virus has features that don't exist in the beta coronavirus family in nature. Okay, so there seem to be, in my opinion, the whole genome of the virus has not yet been elucidated in terms of the meaning of different segments of the genome. There are 30,000 nucleotides. The spike protein is about 13% of that. And so there are a number of things the spike can do that are harmful, but then there are other parts. If you get the virus, there are other parts of the virus that look like human tissue that may be able to stimulate autoimmunity towards your own tissues. Certainly the virus and the vaccine can trigger thrombosis or blood clotting, and that can, and there is damage to the blood vessel walls. And so the tissue that is affected can be anywhere, because any blood vessels can be damaged by spike protein. And so to me, the question, okay, so there, in my opinion, there is a virus. It definitely was made in a lab. The big question is, did it leave the lab by mistake, or was it deliberately spread? Now, since I have a background in biological warfare, I can tell you that one of the reasons you would use a biological warfare agent is because it can't be traced back to you, ideally. So you would choose an agent that looks like somebody else made it, or it came from somewhere else. That's how biological warfare is done. And so if some country wanted to blame China, they would spread it right near the place in China that's doing research on coronaviruses. Therefore, you can't really tell, was it just from what we know today, was it deliberate or was it a mistake? What we do know is that a very synchronized approach to this viral epidemic was carried out in most of the countries of the world at the same time. And that included the suppression of drugs for early treatment, such as chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and ivermectin. And other things were done, for instance, masking and social distancing, that had not really been proven to be effective. And yet these same procedures were used in all these different countries. So there had been some sort of plan in place, apparently, before the epidemic. I say that, yeah, maybe it came in really quickly after the epidemic appeared, but because countries are run by bureaucracies, the bureaucracies are slow moving. So I suspect there was a plan in place before this epidemic was apparent to anyone.
Yeah, I've interviewed a number of people, both on my other podcast, Geopolitics and Empire, as well as on TNT here, and people from all different walks of life with different level, you know, different expertise. And some have called this U.S. biowarfare against China. Others have called this Chinese biowarfare against the U.S. Others have said, you know, they've seen this joint U.S.-China operation in Wuhan, the BSL-4, where you know, we've seen the funding come from you know, Fauci.
Right.
And then the thing that gets me, though, you know, RFK Jr. wrote the book. I've got it right here behind me in a physical copy. I haven't finished it completely yet. But all of these pandemic simulations, it's just, that's for me the thing that I can't square, where you've got from 2001, Dark Winter, you've got SPARS, I think 2017, you've got Crimson Contagion, 2019, you've got Urban Outbreak, you've got even China, and a lot of people don't know this, in China, in September of 2019, China held a simulation of a coronavirus leaking out in an airport in September of 2019, and then everyone knows October, we had Event 201, and so it's just very suspicious. And how do you kind of, it's like they were planning this, and then all of a sudden we get, in 2 months later, you know, Klaus Schwab produces a book titled COVID and the Great Reset. And so how do you kind of square this circle of what's going on?
I don't think it's easy to come up with a definite explanation. I will say that not only did the U.S. support that lab, but so did the European Union. There was a tremendous amount of traffic back and forth between labs in the U.S., Australia, Europe, and the Chinese coronavirus lab. And why was that? So I think the people of the world don't know why their governments are spending taxpayer money to create new virulent microorganisms. And I think, you know, most people don't even know that's going on, let alone that all these nations that are, you know, allegedly enemies are collaborating on this work. Let me just be more explicit for your audience that you just spoke about a series of simulations that are carried out by a mix of governmental and NGOs. So they're often paid for in part by the World Economic Forum or the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or the Wellcome Trust, but they may have actual government officials such as George Gao, the head of the Chinese CDC, was at one of these, the head of MasterCard, you know, the woman who is now the director of national intelligence, April, forget her last name, was at one of these recent simulations. And as Bobby Kennedy explains, this was training these very high-level people a new way to behave in a pandemic. And that new way was to control transportation, to control messaging, to give a single unified message to the population, and also to control the products that might be needed, like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Initially, the limitations placed on hydroxychloroquine were claimed to be for the purpose of avoiding entities stockpiling the drug so that it could be shared freely. But then it turned out that wasn't it at all. It was really being restricted so that people with COVID couldn't get it, even though it was being made available to people with other illnesses, other chronic illnesses primarily, that needed it, such as lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, malaria. You could have hydroxychloroquine for those illnesses, no problem, perfectly safe, over the counter in most of the world. But if you had COVID, it was suddenly too dangerous for you. You couldn't have it. That doesn't make any sense. But this single narrative messaging was so extraordinarily effective that people thought this drug would poison you. It was the Trump drug. That was a brilliant way to frame it. The Trump, you don't want, if you don't like Trump, you don't want the Trump drug, and you'd rather die than take the Trump drug. Yeah. Pretty impressive, yeah. Huh?
Yeah, I've never seen this level of information warfare in my life. I don't think ever in history have we seen anything like this. And, you know, we can talk about that later, the censorship and deplatforming, but to the, I've experienced it as well. But when they say, oh, you've gone against CDC guidelines or WHO guidelines, and so our free speech is cut immediately, that's insane. But just to continue on that theme of biolabs, before we move to like the vaccines and other stuff, also, we've got this stuff in Ukraine. I've interviewed the Bulgarian journalist who's gone to some of these biolabs, I think, in countries like Georgia and Ukraine, and they've got them in Kazakhstan, where I used to live. I lived there from 2017 to 2020 in Kazakhstan. And so, and they're also splattered, throughout the Middle East and South Asia. Do you have any thoughts on these newly discovered, you know, according to Victoria Nuland herself, you know, she admits that, yes, we've got U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine. You know, what are your thoughts on those?
So there've always, I mean, since World War II, pretty much, the United States has had laboratories that studied indigenous pathogens in the third world. Let me put it that way, or the second world. And those were primarily Navy laboratories. But after 9/11, a tremendous amount of money was designated by Congress for dealing with and preparing for pandemics. So this was an extraordinary thing, because anthrax was used in some letters in, you know, after 9/11. And anthrax doesn't even spread person to person. So wherever it lands, that's where it stays. And there were, you know, 22 known, you know, identified cases, and there were 44% deaths. So I think there may have been 10 deaths, something like, no, there were 5 deaths from inhalation anthrax, pardon me. And the other cases were, cases were cutaneous. So there were 11 cutaneous cases and 11 systemic inhaled anthrax. And for those cases, 5 deaths, 22 cases, the United States started spending on average $7 billion a year, and sometimes more, on all sorts of biological warfare gimmicks and other enterprises. And we started building all sorts of BSL-3 and BSL-4 labs in the U.S., many more than we had before. Some people suggested it was because Congress had allotted so much money to the NIH, and they didn't know how to spend it, and they didn't have time to review all these research proposals, so that if they built labs with it, they wouldn't have to, you know, use their personnel to evaluate proposals, and they could spend it. So there was a huge, it was a growth industry. If you wanted to, you know, if you were a scientist, a biological scientist, you wanted to get grants, you started doing something that you could call biological defense. At the same time, there's people around like Hunter Biden and Joe Biden who are looking for a way to make money. And that method is kickbacks. And you have to, how do you get kickbacks? You have to spend money. You have to spend a lot of money on something, right? And then you can get your cut. Well, what's the best way to do, is the best way to do it in the United States, where, you know, there's taxes and records and, you know, there used to be the rule of law. No, the best way is to spend that money in a place like Afghanistan or Ukraine, where anything goes. And no one's ever going to get those records, or so we thought. So Hunter thought, and Joe. And so it made sense to build. You don't want to build biolabs in a place where, you know, disease could spread, you would think. But in fact, in the United States, we've built our biggest animal pathogen bio lab, biodefense lab in Manhattan, Kansas, in the middle of, you know, livestock area. And one of the major biodefense labs was built in Galveston, Texas, right in the middle of the hurricane region. And it was flooded and destroyed at one point from a hurricane. So people don't always do the smart things, especially in peacetime. During World War II, when the United States was building biological warfare and defense labs, it often built the experimental stations off the coast on islands. So Plum Island off the coast of Long Island in New York was a center for biological warfare research. And I can't remember the name, but an island off of Mississippi was another center. That's a smarter thing to do, because if you've got a lot of ocean around your island, you're probably not going to spread illnesses to the mainland. In the case of Ukraine, I'm not sure, the original spending was supposed to help to sort of pacify nuclear sites. So there were a lot of nuclear weapons when Ukraine was part of the former Soviet Union. There were many sites with nuclear weapons. And so the Nunn-Lugar Act was designed to spend taxpayer money to make sure that the nuclear weapons were taken care of, were properly disposed of, et cetera. And then the same packet of money was used for chemical and biological agents. So the money that was supposed to make sure that these agents were being safely disposed of turned into money to build biolabs that would then presumably research dangerous pathogens, or at a minimum, collect them from the local environment and transfer them back to the United States and possibly to other countries. You know, the Peter Daszak and EcoHealth Alliance were set up as a pass-through organization. So the NIH would give them money, you know, Tony Fauci's NIAID would fund them. So did the Defense Department. So did USAID, the National Science Foundation, and another federal agency. I can't remember which one. I think something else with the State Department. And Peter Daszak's organization had contracts with scientists in 31 different countries. So they're all collecting viruses, and we don't know what else they were doing. Diljana, who you interviewed, has said that these labs were, in fact, you know, researching and inventing, creating new dangerous pathogens and causing epidemics locally. Mm-hmm. I have not seen the evidence for that, so I do not know if that is true. You would have hoped that if that actually had happened, the media would have covered these dangerous epidemics, but perhaps they were controlled even before the last couple of years. So I think we should be very suspicious of these labs. The United States is not the only country that has them. But I don't think anyone outside the people who work there and the people who fund them knows exactly what they were doing. Certainly, part of the reason they were there was basically to make money available to people like Joe and Hunter Biden.
All right. With that, Dr. Nass, we're going to have to take a break. No one go anywhere. This is TNT Radio.
On air and on the app.
I listen on the app.
Stay up to date around the clock.
I listen, therefore I know.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's R-A-I-N-N dot O-R-G.
Brought to you by Rain and this station.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America.
I'm a quadriplegic. I'm definitely at risk.
I'm very concerned about, would there be a bed for me? Would there be a ventilator for me?
Join me and help fight for them by supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America.
They're making sure that we have all of the food and supplies that we need right now.
To find out how you can help, please go to helppva.org. That's helppva.org.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, and we're back. I'm your host, Hrvoje Morić, on TNT Radio. Live. We've been talking to Dr. Meryl Nass, who you can find. She's still on Twitter. She hasn't been deplatformed, at NASSMERYL. Also, her website's anthraxvaccine.blogspot.com, as well as merylnass.substack.com and merylnassmd.com. So maybe we can switch over from the biolabs to vaccines. On your blog, you recently posted about the vaccine adverse effects. You pointed to Steve Kirsch, whose Substack I love, and Jessica Rose as having more expertise on looking at the VAERS data. It's funny because next week I'll be talking to Jessica on my Geopolitics and Empire podcast. And, you know, I personally have no problem saying at this point, I just don't subscribe anymore to the vaccine ideology. I've found that the cost far outweighs the benefit. And what are the problems that you've been seeing over the last 2 years with these vaccines? Some people call them DARPA gene therapy. It's just all kinds of crazy stuff going on. Could you give us kind of the 101? What's up with these COVID vaccinations?
What happened after the anthrax letters was, and the anthrax vaccine program, was that the Congress passed a bill called the PREP Act, they passed several bills designed to help the country prepare and for biological warfare or agents or pandemics like H5N1, you know, bird flu. So there had been years of people trying to create fear over these potential future epidemics. And this bill, the PREP Act, gave the federal government the power to issue something called an emergency use authorization, which could be granted to a drug or vaccine in the event of if you designate an emergency. All the FDA has to do is decide that the benefit is likely to be greater than the risk. And that's all the evidence you need. You don't need a single clinical trial. You don't ever have to have tested the product in human beings, and you can give it an emergency use authorization, and the manufacturer will have no liability whatsoever. So if this drug or vaccine kills people, you can't sue the manufacturer. And this created a sort of gold mine, a potential gold mine for companies that would produce products for these designated emergencies. And so what happened is, you know, Trump and anyone else who was in the position of a president or other leaders of the world, they have really no idea what the normal process is for getting a vaccine, you know, from idea to in arms, you know, injections. That process normally takes more than 10 years. And because you don't want to inject the wrong thing into people. We've had polio programs early in the United States in the 1950s that gave children polio. There was a dengue vaccine used in the Philippines just a couple of years ago that caused over 100 children to die because the vaccine induced something called enhanced disease, enhanced dengue, vaccine enhanced disease. It made the immune system work in a way that caused the dengue to be much more severe than it would have been otherwise. And that vaccine, by the way, that dengue vaccine is now licensed in the United States for kids aged 9 to 16 if they have antibodies and show they've previously had dengue. So as I say, vaccines can kill you as well as help you. And there are vaccines in cats that that cause cancer. There are other vaccines have caused hypothyroidism. There's a lot of problems, potential problems with vaccines. There is not enough science to know what a vaccine is going to do to people until you actually test it in people. The response of animals to vaccines or drugs is not necessarily the same as the response in humans. And, you know, most people don't know that. So anyway, by creating this pathway and by giving the manufacturers this enormous benefit of not being subject to any liability for the product, no matter whether it works or whether it harms people, a dangerous situation was created. And now we're living with that dangerous situation. So a number of, as I said, the standard, the statutory standard for the FDA is it may be effective, and the known and potential benefits outweigh the known and potential risks. So it's a very low bar. So the vaccines that we are using were subjected to that very low bar, and they were given authorizations and approvals based on limited evidence, 2 months of evaluation. So for every age group, they were studied. The vaccine was studied in a certain number of people for 2 months, and then the control group was vaccinated, and it was no longer possible to tell what the side effects would be. And now we see that that was done deliberately, because the vaccines work reasonably well for a couple of months, and then their effectiveness starts to drop rapidly. And so if you stop looking for effectiveness after 2 months, you will miss that drop. In any event, so that's what happened. Most Americans and many people around the, you know, billions of people around the world got these vaccines. And now we have learned that there are a lot more problems than allegedly were anticipated. So there's a lot of problems with blood clots. The spike protein can damage the walls of blood vessels and induce blood clots, potentially induce bleeding, cause blood vessels to rupture. This can lead to heart attacks, pulmonary emboli, strokes, and many other conditions. In fact, the FDA told us last July that that in the Medicare database, they were seeing more heart attacks and more pulmonary emboli, which are blood clots in the lungs that are potentially deadly. In fact, they probably kill 100 to 200,000 Americans a year. So these are big problems. These are major diagnoses that cause deaths. And FDA, in the 8 months since last July, has not informed us how they concluded their investigations. They said they were going to study this more rigorously and come up with an answer and let the public know, but they haven't. We do know that myocarditis in two databases, one from Kaiser Permanente and one in the West Coast and one from Hong Kong, have showed that in male teenagers aged 12 to 17, the likelihood of getting myocarditis after the second dose is 1 in 2,700. And in the Kaiser data alone, the likelihood of boys aged 18 to 24 getting myocarditis after the second dose is 1 in 2,000. Now, those are just the cases that get diagnosed, that go to the doctor and have chest pain or have enough symptoms that they get an expensive workup. We do not know, we have no idea how many people are getting cases of myocarditis that may not present with chest pain, may not be obvious. And then these are people who are keeling over, you know, on the sports field or in their car and having an accident. So there are a lot of questions. We also have some data from three insurance companies, and one of the people who released the data in Germany from his insurance company got fired. Which reveals that people in the working age, in other words, 18 to 65 years old, have been dying at rates considerably higher approximately 40% higher than usual if you go back to the years before the pandemic and compare the death rates. So there, and then there are many other issues that more deaths have been reported to the federal government's vaccine adverse reporting system, which is run by FDA and CDC. More deaths have been reported for the COVID vaccines to that system than were reported over the last 30 years since the system started for every vaccine, all of them added together over 30 years. Fewer deaths than would have been reported in a little over a year regarding the COVID vaccines. So there are some serious problems. The federal agencies have not given us enough data to where we can understand the extent of the problems, to how to ameliorate the problems. And I can't tell you whether these vaccines do more harm than good, but it's looking that way.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. And yeah, I have seen a lot of the stuff you've talked about. And I think for a lot of us that are concerned enough to go down these rabbit holes, like we come to the same, we see most of this similar data and come to the similar conclusions. And it's just mind-boggling how this is not breaking into the mainstream. And, there's someone that I know from my church, older woman. She was in her 80s. A year ago, she took the vaccine, and right after that, she passed away. And just recently, I'm here in Mexico, and one of my Mexican friends revealed to me his friend in his 30s, young person. I am assuming like probably somewhere in his 30s, just out of the blue, gets Guillain-Barré syndrome. And this this person is someone who's taken, as you know, many people, a number of people here in Mexico have just followed the narrative, just do what the government tells you. And this is not normal. Like, you don't just get Guillain-Barré out of the blue. You don't just get people taking shots and killing over. And as you say, I guess you don't know the answer to that question. Are the vaccines going to kill more people than COVID? And yet we see also there, I hear about, we've got all these boosters, like 4 times, 5 times, 6 injections. And now they're going to approve like Moderna booster shots. It's just, they keep going. And I think you tweeted also that, quote, they said you can't keep a secret when so many are involved. You know, Kennedy assassination proved them wrong. I agree with you. How many people knew at Pfizer, FDA, HHS, Oracle about the carnage that required 600 new hires by Pfizer simply to process the paperwork? I can't believe anymore that they don't know what's going on. Like, this is, it's become sinister at this point. And so, yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I know, absolutely. These agencies are absolutely hiding information. They're spinning information, twisting information. You know, people go from country to country trying to figure out where is the information that we can trust. And for a while, it seemed like it was Israel, but now Israel is, you know, telling stories. And it looked like the UK was releasing a lot of good information. I had blogged about some of it, which showed that people who had gotten 2 doses of vaccine, not the boosters, but only 2 doses initially, were dying at a higher rate than people who had never been vaccinated. So that has been happening recently in the United Kingdom, particularly in England. The New York Times ran an article at the end of February by journalist Apoorva Mandavilli, which revealed that the CDC is hiding most of their data. So they had about 10 different people who were, most of whom wouldn't give their names, but a few did, talking about how the CDC, CDC data is completely useless. And even the White House has said they were using foreign data to try to figure out how to manage the pandemic. So, you know, this doesn't happen by accident. You know, the CDC would like us to think that their computer systems are outdated, and if you only gave them money, they could do better. But this has to be deliberate. This is not how public health works. This is not how things have ever worked before. We have, you know, a new pandemic, a new paradigm, and it's a complete information control problem. So I think when you're in that situation, you can't calculate the benefits of the vaccine or the benefits of any of the other policies because we're being, you know, fooled. So what you have to do is basically take care of yourself and your family and avoid doing something that you can't reverse. And getting a vaccination for COVID is something you can't reverse. Now, I don't mean to give the impression that every vaccine is going to be the same. I don't think they are, but because we don't have enough information to compare them, we don't know what's going on. And we're not exactly sure what's even in these vaccines, because when people from multiple, I've seen slides from Australia, New Zealand, Europe, and the United States, when people look at these vaccines under the microscope, they see small particulate matter that is not supposed to be there. And even the manufacturer, Pfizer, says in some of their licensing documents that they did not characterize these little particulates. They said it appeared that when you drew them up into a syringe, they were not, you know, visible anymore. Some of them are visible, most of them aren't. And what does that mean? I mean, a syringe is a cloudy plastic. It's not, you know, it's not glass. And so the fact that they couldn't see them when they drew the stuff up into a syringe means absolutely nothing. And it's a reflection of the fact that Pfizer and the FDA together are, you know, hiding something.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. There's a lot of people talking about stuff like graphene. I know the Australian Senator Malcolm Roberts, who I've interviewed in the past and who has his own program, I think once a week here on TNT radio. Last week, he has been listening to a lot of testimony there in Australia, and some are saying he's the first politician to now begin openly speaking about exactly what you're saying, these strange things, ingredients in the vaccines. And I know, I remember a few months ago, Del Bigtree's organization, I'm forgetting it now. I know he does a high wire, but is it I can.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. That I subscribe to their newsletter, and that they were suing, I think it was Pfizer or who that was keeping.
Yes.
Ingredient secret, like it's 20% right. of the ingredient, and it's like that right there is a huge flag. There's no liability for for them if we have an adverse effect, and you're hiding 20% of the ingredient. And I would just like to mention to listeners, I rarely like to donate money to any sorts of organizations these days. I've learned that NGOs mostly are corrupted, and you know, many of them are used by the military industrial pharmaceutical complex. But there's two that I've felt very comfortable donating to. That's Children's Health Defense and ICANN, because I think you can see them having success suing these corrupt institutions. And so, you know, what are your thoughts on like graphene, and do you think eventually the dam will break and this stuff is going to come to light, these injuries and deaths? Like I remember the 1976 swine flu. Well, I wasn't alive back then, but I remember reading about it, that after a few dozen people died from the swine flu vaccine, the government immediately, you know, came out and said, we're halting this. You know, what are your thoughts there?
Well, you're absolutely right. So there were, I think, 400 cases of Guillain-Barré in the United States, and maybe 30 deaths, and the entire program was halted. Similarly, there were about a small number of deaths, 30 or less, of intussusception in 1999, when a rotavirus vaccine, it was an oral vaccine, it was pills, but it was a vaccine, it was a live virus, and that was causing a condition that led to babies requiring surgery. And after, you know, a relatively small number of cases, that vaccine was taken off the market. Suddenly, all the systems that should be, you know, stopping this program at the federal level, the FDA and the CDC, particularly the FDA, they're not working. They have a staff of people whose job is to assess the safety of vaccines, and they are not doing so. They are not taking the data. They are not, it's such a mess. It's everything you look at has been done wrong. None of it is according to standard operating procedures. And it's just a mess. I mean, it's so extraordinary. I can't even, you know, it's hard for me to begin to tell you. The cycle thresholds on the PCR tests were set at the wrong level to pick up cases when there were no cases. So there were too many false positives on the PCR tests. But then when CDC wanted there to be less cases, and I don't know why, but this was around the time of the Biden presidency beginning, all of a sudden they said hospitals could not report COVID cases unless they had a cycle threshold of under 28, which meant that they were going to miss a lot of cases. So first, CDC is setting up standards that cause the PCR test to reveal many false positives. And then they set up a different system, but only for reporting deaths and cases where they're going to have a lot of false negatives. And it's just been like that, you know, ever since the beginning. We have 425 different tests for COVID in the United States that have been authorized by the FDA. That means none of them have been approved. The word approved means licensed. That means the FDA had to actually go through a rigorous process, supposedly rigorous, to give them a license. Instead, they've done that for no tests for COVID, and they have allowed 425 different tests to come into the United States, not compared them to each other, not informed the public how well they work. You know, sometimes you'll see a study from another country, like there was a study from the UK of their rapid COVID tests, and they found there was a 58% rate of accuracy in one study. So these are the tests we're using in the United States. And it seems that so many things have been designed to just keep confusion going, to keep people frightened, even when right now we're probably at about 75 or 80% of the US population with immunity. But that doesn't matter. You know, now Fauci is writing articles saying you can't achieve herd immunity because the virus mutates so quickly. Even if you've had it before, you know, even if you've gotten the vaccine, there's no herd immunity, blah, blah, blah. So people are the intention is to keep everybody frightened about this disease, even if they have probably, like me, I had COVID in January. I probably have pretty darn good immunity, and I'll probably have it for at least several years, minimum. But I am supposed to be scared stiff to go into a grocery store. And unfortunately, a lot of people still are. And once you've got them scared, you can control them much better.
Yeah, we've got a few minutes left, and I just wanted to bring up, I don't know how much you've looked into it, but my biggest fear out of all of this is, well, first, the vaccine passport, which I view as a totalitarian device. And I mean, this goes into other things, but you know, it's morphing into this digital ID passport, which is then becoming like a management system for a social credit system. And here in the state where I am in Mexico, they were even, it's like an internal Soviet passport system. They were talking about, we've seen in Canada, you couldn't go between provinces. Yeah. Even here in Mexico now, this crazy governor has floated the idea of you can't leave the state of Jalisco where I am enter or exit without a vaccine passport. And they had just introduced them this January, and they just like a few weeks ago took them away, and they were just for limited locations. But this is, for me, like, I don't see any justification for this type of thing. And it's totalitarian. Like they determine if you can buy food, even in supermarkets. One Mexican state applied it across the board, even for supermarkets and public parks, nature. Like you have to have a vaccine certificate to go to the park. So, you know, you can't buy food, you can't travel, you can't work. Where I used to work here at the university in Mexico, one of my colleagues was fired because she refused to be injected. And it's legal. It's unconstitutional, actually, but they're getting away with it here, some of the big corporations. And so what are your thoughts on in the few minutes we have left on these vaccine passports?
Sure. Well, first of all, the vaccines work for a very brief time. So the vaccine passport idea is premised on the fact that the vaccines actually are giving you immunity. the fact that Nancy Pelosi just had a positive test, so did the Attorney General of the United States, and who else? Another member of the cabinet, and some other people, all of whom were fully vaccinated, and they all came out with positive tests, and some of them have symptoms and some don't, shows you the vaccines are basically worthless. And a lot of data shows that the boosters, after about 8 weeks, have very, very low efficacy. An Israeli study in hundreds of healthcare workers, they gave them a fourth booster, and they found after 8 weeks, if they gave the Moderna vaccine as a booster, they had 11% protection, 11%, nothing. And the Pfizer, they had 30%. Similar numbers are being shown for the pediatric vaccines. The vaccines in 5 to 11-year-olds in New York State, 365,000 children, they found the vaccine after 8 weeks was 11% or 12% effective. So why would you need a pass if the vaccines don't work, if they can't possibly reveal, you know, whether you're carrying COVID or not? If that's what they really want to know, is whether you're carrying COVID and could give it to somebody else, maybe they would want to do a test on you. But of course, the tests aren't that accurate either. The thing they don't want to do is treat you early. If everybody got COVID and got the drugs that are appropriate at the beginning of the illness, almost nobody would need to go to the hospital and almost nobody would die. But then you couldn't scare people if you made those drugs available. So the whole passport thing has nothing to do with protecting the public. Of course, the public doesn't know that yet. What can I say? Obviously, it's another surveillance tool. Obviously, what the government would like is for us to all pay our monthly cell phone fee and carry around our own homing device, you know, and then they could probably drone us if they wanted, because they'd know exactly where we are all the time. You know, why would you need a vaccine, even if the vaccine worked, to go out in the park? It's virtually impossible to catch COVID outdoors. There's something called wind. You know, there's not enough virus, you know, in the air. You can catch it indoors, but really outside, unless someone spits at you, you can't catch it outside. And I think the CDC admitted there's no evidence of anybody catching it outside. So, you know, this is foolish. This is basically just a control system.
Yep. I think people should be able to realize this. Some people are fearing another lockdown in the fall. I mean, do you think we're done with this, or you think they're going to try it, you know, another Hail Mary?
Well, I think if they get away with it, they could certainly try it again. Do they work? Is there any evidence that lockdowns work? You know, why haven't we been doing lockdowns for influenza, or why weren't we doing them for measles? You know, lockdowns is a new invention. It was a way to stop people from going to work and force you to shop at large supermarkets and, you know, Walmarts, places that had no better ventilation than little stores that could open their door. You know, you go into a Walmart, where's the window? Where's the door? You're breathing the same air as everybody else. There was no reason why people were allowed to shop in these large big box stores, but that we had to close the mom and pop stores. No, that, you know, maybe it seems like it had economic impacts, huge economic impacts, but no definite health impacts. If you really wanted people to be protected, you wouldn't have told them to go make their own masks out of cloth. You wouldn't tell them to use, now everybody knows the cloth masks don't work and they're wearing surgical masks or pretend surgical masks. And nobody's told them that they work just the same as the cloth masks, which is not at all. If our governments were trying to protect us, they would have explained how to use an N95 mask, how to put it on, how to take it off, you know, what protection it provides, what protection it doesn't provide, etc. They've never done that. So I feel that that these measures were not imposed for our benefit.
All right, we're just about out of time. Real quick, where are the best places for people to find you?
Thank you. So I have a Substack, merylnass.substack.com, and I have a website, merylnassmd.com, merylnass. I appreciate it. I'm often writing Children's Health Defense, and I'm on Children's Health Defense TV on Fridays.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join me, Dr. Nass. You've boiled things down in this hour. I hope I got a lot out of it, and I hope others have as well. That'll do it for today's Prvoje More show on TNT Radio. That's all, folks.